you're on record as saying that most Christian films are awful.
It sounds terrible. You make me sound absolutely terrible, but of course it's true. They are. Some of mine are probably as well.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
You are listening to Premier Christian Radio, and this is The Profile, our weekly long-form interview with a Christian who has made a significant contribution to the world. I'm Tony Wilson, and I write for Premier Christianity, the partner magazine of this show. As well as our monthly magazine, we publish daily news and comment on our website, premierchristianity.com. If you head over there, you'll find our latest subscription offers. Today, I have the great pleasure to be talking with the film and TV producer-director Norman Stone. Norman comes from a family with a rich Christian heritage, with his grandfather, father, and uncles all having been Baptist ministers of the strict and particular variety. His career in film and TV took off at the BBC, where he directed many productions for series such as Everyman and Miss Marple. Norman directed the original Shadowlands film, winning 2 BAFTAs and several international awards for his depiction of the love and loss experienced by C.S. Lewis through the illness and death of his wife from cancer. His lifelong appreciation of the work of Lewis features in several of his films, most notably the critically acclaimed 2021 film, The Most Reluctant Convert. With several projects in the pipeline, Norman is still very much in the saddle as a storyteller for our times. Norman Stone, welcome to The Profile.
Pleasure to be here.
So we start the profile with a dive into the formative years of a guest's life, but I always like to open with a quick fire question, just 30 seconds or so. I'd really like to know, in the last 12 months, what would you say has made the biggest impression on you from a film or TV perspective?
The need for patience. That's probably it. It isn't particularly new. I've regularly had to be patient, but it's particularly frustrating when you've got something. I'm working on 3 projects now that mean an awful lot to me. And at various times, you've just got to say, well, we'll just wait another 3 months or wait another 2 weeks and so on. The stuff is good. The stuff gets better in your own mind as a creator anyway. And then you suddenly say, can I go now? And they say, in a minute. And it still drags on. Hopefully it works out well in the end. It's like a horse chewing at the bit. You just want to gallop and you're not yet allowed to.
I get the impression from everything I've heard of you is that you're a man full of ideas. And I imagine that the processes of bringing a film to full production can be, and particularly at the funding stage, I'm sure could require a lot of patience. So I want to take a look now at your family life as you grew up, the formative experience of growing up in this rich Christian tradition. And I wonder if you could paint a picture of family life for us.
It was a happy family, happy life. I had a sister, 2 parents and a dog. And it was interesting because it was very much we go to church and we go to the prayer meeting and we do all the usual things that ministers' children do. It was also a little unusual and exciting. My father would be feel called to go to another church, sometimes 300 miles away, and live there. So we did that. And it was all very staid and steady. For the first 9 years, I lived in the middle of many uncles and many aunties and many cousins. Then from 9 onwards, we were in various churches as my dad preached and saw lots of, as we would say, blessing. There's a lot of good things happened, which is interesting, actually, because I never had a problem believing in God. That was not the problem. Did God exist? The problem was that he probably did. In fact, he absolutely did. And I was feeling, hang on, I'm only 16. Come on, let me have my own life first, please, before it all has to wear grey suits and sad expressions and things and go to church.
So it's a little bit like Augustine saying, oh, well, make me a Christian, but not yet. So,
exactly. I didn't know that. It was a good line. I copy it. Yes.
It is a good line. So so many ministers' children react against the upbringing that they've had, they often get a second helping from after the minister's given all that he has for his congregation. You didn't feel a need to rebel? You didn't feel that you wanted to reject?
No, I was certainly when I was younger, not particularly at all. When I was going through into my teens and so on, I was very much a mod, not a rocker, if you can remember back to that far away. And yes, it was in a village, but my scooter could get me out to other places. And yes, I was wanting to be exciting and cool and different and all this. And then we'd go and sing Sankey's hymns or have a six-hour sermon, not quite, and so on like that. But my main job for me as a person to myself was to make sure that nobody knew I was interested, because I didn't want pressure from, oh, the minister's boy, yes, oh, yes, he's just, you know, he'll get baptized soon and all that. Didn't want that. I wanted to be me. Mm-hmm. And God pursued, got me. Mm-hmm. And then let me be me, which was wonderful, except with him as well. That was a surprise for me when I finally genuinely gave in. And mm-hmm. I thought, if Jesus has died for me, and this was deeper than it sounds now, very deep for me, then mm-hmm. the least I can do is live for him. And I actually did commit and become a Christian. That was one of the most important thing in my whole life. Mm-hmm. From that point on, it was initially amazement that it was so filling, life-giving, and I have to say it, fun. There was tremendous scopes of everything. You're doing this in the light of an almighty God in eternity, and it's great. And there's mm-hmm. so much to do. So I was the loser for the first few years when I was resisting so assiduously. It was made up in much more, I got well paid emotionally, if you like.
And I think the common misconception from the outside of looking in is that somehow the Christian faith is rather restrictive and it sort of puts boundaries around us. But actually, your testimony and mine too, is that actually it broadens the horizons, it opens up a vista that you'd previously not seen. And so I think that's a powerful story.
Can I say, let's be fair, sometimes churches do give the impression of boredom and dullness mm-hmm. and all the things that you have just said and imagined. But no, mm-hmm. you're right. When you meet God, it's different from meeting a church committee.
Thank goodness, that's certainly true. So your first memories of your grandfather, I think, were really formative in terms of turning you into a storyteller. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, that's my granddad on my mother's side, Arthur Gordon, Scottish heritage, came down to Hartlepool and survived. Yes, he was a lovely guy, great painter, poor as a church mouse, kept his family together by whichever way he could. And yes, told me stories. I remember at the age of three, the first time he sat me on his knee and told me a story. And the most odd thing is I saw pictures. Now, I didn't have a television. This is way back in the early 50s, very early 50s. And I saw these pictures. His mouth spoke. I watched his lips, but I could see the pictures that backed up the story. And now, all these years later, I can remember that story in detail. I mean, it wasn't very deep, but it was a specific detail because I watched the pictures in my head still. And mm-hmm. that is crazy. And it was only much, much later, once I became a director, someone said, "Why did you become a director?" And I thought hard about it. And it was back there on my granddad's knee. From that first story, my goodness, I was on his knee every time I visited the house with him and my nana. We went there, and I had more stories, another one, granddad. And, yeah, he died when I was six, but I got an awful lot of stories in between the three and six.
And so that lit in you a desire to be a storyteller, it would seem, in terms of the career that you've had.
Well, I didn't think of it that way. You must understand. I just went on and I knew what I liked and I loved. And these were Christian parables, many of them. He made up himself, and they had an effect on me, obviously. But no, I didn't plan that I'd become anything because of the stories. I just loved them. and I love the pictures.
I want to unpack that a little bit, because I think it's really important that we note that Jesus was perhaps the best storyteller ever in terms of the parables that he constructed. But more than that, the Bible comes to us as a series of stories, stories of individuals, stories of nations. God chose not to give us a systematic theology. He gave us an unfolding story of his revelation to a group of people. And it reminded me a little bit of the Mandelbrot set. Do you remember the fractal, where you had this, like an ink blot island with an intricate coast, and every time you zoom in to the island, the pattern repeats itself, and you can never ever zoom in far enough that the pattern stops repeating. And it feels to me that the Bible is a bit like that in our lives. It creates something that has a resonance with our own stories, and God writes a story for our life as we go through life, and we pick up a sort of resonance that we see in the Bible. Do you sort of sense that God is a storyteller?
Oh yeah, of course. Yes, absolutely. I don't think it's interesting. It's when Jesus told his parables, they were great parables, and they were homesy and in people's faces. It was where they lived, it's where they thought. But equally, he didn't go then and explain it in 15 different points and say, well, that actually means that, and therefore salvation equals that. And he just told the stories and left the rest to his Father. And that is something we get carried away in the wrong direction of, I think, sometimes. Stories are useful if they bring people here and they make that happen in their lives or become Christians. Stories are the truth of God, if you look at the parables. They are God's truth, and he leaves them with us. And we ourselves step into the light of that story if we wish to do that. And it really does have a powerful spiritual effect. But we will tend, especially if we're not storytellers, we will tend to only practice them if they can have an effect, a specific effect, and that was what must be done. I think we've got to trust God a lot more than that. Mm.
God does speak to us so powerfully through those parables, and yet isn't it incredible that you can read a parable dozens and dozens of times through your life, and yet it can say something very fresh and new every time you read it? Something you never saw before comes out, because you're not the same person that you were when you read it the last time, because your story's moved on and changed. And So there's a dynamism to the story. It's ever fresh, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's true. And I think that I used to watch flannel graphs. Remember them flannel graphs? You'd stick various biblical characters. And the most exciting thing was if, I don't know, Peter and John fell off. Got of those. So let's be over special with the stories. It's just that I think it's the same in many, many ways. Have you never read the Bible and a text jumps out at you, and you've read that text many, many times before, or a chapter or a chunk of verses, and it really speaks to you. Mm-hmm. It speaks, not like reading a classic book or Dickens. The Bibles actually can go, wow, look at that. That's exactly what I need now. That's exactly for me. Yeah. 2 weeks later, you read the same thing and you just scoot over it. It's God behind it. Speaks very clearly through that, and often through the stories in the Bible too, yes.
And sometimes you read something and you think, who slipped that in when I wasn't looking? You know, I feel like I've never read that before. So it is an extraordinary, extraordinary document. So I'm intrigued now. So we've got you to a point where you make a faith commitment, and then you choose to study. Where did you actually go to study? And so we're probably sort of late 60s by this stage when you go and study.
Yes, 68. I went off to art college. I remember being excited at school, and I realized, you know, you are there to learn to do a job. You mean there's a place I can go and paint and draw and do things that are creative? I didn't know that. The nearest I'd got was I knew that you needed journalists, and that would sound fun, or authors. I could write stories. Mm-hmm. But then you realize art college is there. And I went in 68 to Leicester, mm-hmm. Leicester College of Art. And it was a one-year course, a pre-diploma course. John Lennon had just become the titular head of the art college. Mm-hmm. We never saw him, but they were very proud of that as a big signal. Mm-hmm. And after 1 year of living on next to nothing, it wasn't much money around, there wasn't much food around, but you try everything. Then I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to make films or at least graphic design so I could illustrate, and cartoons, and then animation. And that was wonderful. And I managed to get into a college for 3 years. That was the diploma, or Bachelor of Arts, as it became. I did all sorts of different design work, but was very hungry to do animation, very hungry to make film. But there's a difference if you go to a three-year art college and they say, what are you going to do today? Here's your paper, here's your pencil. And mm-hmm. I say, well, I'm going to make a film. And that costs a lot of money. They mm-hmm. have limited resources. So I had to wait until the last year to really cut loose with my films. And boy, did I enjoy it. It felt like coming home. Mm-hmm. And it made a big impression on me. And I followed that through with the Royal College of Art, doing nothing but film and TV.
So the Royal College of Art, where was that?
That was in London, right in near London. The Natural History and Science Museum.
Yes.
So we were in the it's just weird. We're in the ex-whale stuffing department of the Natural History and Science Museum, because that was the only place that had a big enough room for a studio. So there you go.
What an image. And so I'm now imagining you sort of, we're at the turn of the 70s here. You land in London with a faith commitment, and London, particularly in the arts world, you must have seen an awful lot, and yet your faith through that time was strong and solid.
Oh yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, I not my faith was particularly wonderful, but I was loving it and loving taking the Christian perspective and learning out that it wasn't all about propaganda and shouting and so on. Just because I was a Christian, I didn't just have to make films about the crucifixion or paint the disciples. It was about speaking in the art form, in whatever it is, and film was mine, and getting people to think. And I still believe it makes people feel so much that you can't help but think. That's what television, that's what film does. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it takes a lot of practice and a lot of learning and a lot of ability to be taught to you. And that was what the Royal College of Art did. I have to say, there was also not far from my college, I could walk it in 20 minutes, a place called the Arts Centre Group. And that was run by a man called Nigel Goodwin, still with us, and has inspired more professional artists and communicators in this world than I've ever met before. The Arts Centre Group was started by Cliff Richard, of all people, and David Winter, and as I say, Nigel Goodwin. And it was just getting together and arguing over this and that, or having a Bible study for that. But it was just you've connected with a society that was hungry for ideas, thoughts, interests, and your faith also. That was a bizarre thing. And it went really well. It went around the world. You had to be a professional or a student to get in. And it was hugely influential in my development into film. And I had total confidence in my faith and total confidence in the art of film. And you can really do things there. You can make people think and laugh and cry. And you can talk to people in a way that they could understand.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate. Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
You're on record as saying that most Christian films are awful, and I get the impression that that might be because they're the sort of films that don't make you think. What's your reasoning behind that?
It sounds terrible. You make me sound absolutely terrible, but of course it's true. They are. Some of mine are probably as well. The point is, it's the understanding of what film's there for. It isn't propaganda. It isn't bend the truth and pull them in, however you have to do it. It's telling the truth. It's realizing we're in the presence of and the world of God and Christ with us, and we can make statements and tell stories and do films about absolutely anything from a Christian perspective. I cannot not make a film from a Christian perspective if I'm a believing Christian. But the only option for that is not to go and be a propagandist. Heavens, for goodness sake, no. Jesus was not a propagandist, and he didn't follow his parables, as I said earlier, with a 20-point idea plan that you've got to go through because you've heard the story. No, no, no. We're here to tell the truth and be trusted, and at the same time, people respond to truth if they see it. They do. And I can make a film about heroin addiction on one hand, or I can make a film about C.S. Lewis on the other hand, and I will make it as a Christian with a worldview from Christianity. And if it's true, it will have an effect.
So are you saying that Christian filmmakers sometimes don't trust God enough to let him join the dots for people as they see the film?
I don't think... I can say what Christian filmmakers think at that point, other than it's wrong if they think they have to preach on film. I'm a very great believer in preaching and in the God's word being explained and in Bible study and conversations. Yes, but it is possible. Like, you can paint a picture without a religious content. You can make a film without religious banging you on the head content. But if you are making it as a Christian, look at Rembrandt's paintings. He was a Christian man. Look at that humanity and stuff in there. But he wasn't a propagandist, but he was telling the truth. And we still go and queue to look at those pictures because he was telling facts, truth, and humanity to us from a Christian perspective again. So in America in particular, I have to say, they tend to be justify your filmmaking by, do evangelistic, I should say, films. And that is not necessarily the truth at all. I've made a lot of films that people would think were Christians. I made a lot of films that people, I hope, would still say they're true. And I make that as a Christian. And I love to see people becoming Christians, but I don't have to con them. I don't have to pretend. I don't have to trim the truth. Just tell them the whole thing. Thank you very much. Read a bit of C.S. Lewis as well. He knew what he was about. Yeah,
sure. And I was thinking also of Tolkien, because I wonder if this is something about the timelessness of Tolkien, because he tells the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings from a Christian worldview, and yet never mentions God. God doesn't feature in that particular world, and yet there are innumerable Christian themes that run richly through that story. And I wonder if that's a lesson in Christian art making.
Yes, I think it's individuals responding to their faith and talking with God about what they do. I mean, the mighty story of Tolkien still captivates everyone. Netflix are about to go and do Narnia Chronicles again as well, with the lady who directed Barbie, Greta Gerwig. And why do they do that? Because C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, good friends as they were, had different approaches. It was that one started this and one started the other. Lewis was much more noticeably Christian allegory. He said he made a supposal, suppose that there was a lion called Aslan, suppose that. Whereas Tolkien went deeply and for year after year after year into the battles of good and evil and the strength. You're absolutely right. His Christian faith is at the root of his work. But you see what I mean? He didn't have to keep mentioning John 3:16 every other page of his book. Not at all. But people want to read it and they get a structure to see what's there. Mm-hmm. I suppose what I'm saying is I tend to distrust art if it says it's evangelical, and I'm an evangelical Christian, but if it's evangelistic in process, just tell them about Jesus and live it out. That's what you need, rather than think of it as posters all the time.
And do you think it's just impossible to depict Jesus on film?
No. I think it's impossible to depict Jesus in funny cartoons. Not well. I've went through a few of that because I used to do animation quite a bit. And rubber-nosed Jesuses don't work. neither should they. It's a mighty thing. This is the corner of the universe, the swinging of black versus white, light versus darkness. And it's massive. And to have a little bounce about cartoon doesn't work. And I've seen people try it, and on tracts as well, bless them. But you look at something like, well, let's take a savage one. You look at something like Mel Gibson's famous film, The Passion of the Christ. I mean, that's powerful. And that works in its way. There's great reverence that has to be there with the truth of it as well. And it's too easy to, and we've seen them ourselves, it's too easy to make a light film about Jesus. All his friends wear tea cloths on their heads and he's a nice guy. It's deeper than that. It's much deeper than that. But you can, of course, you can do it. And I think somewhere like Angel Studios at the moment, who are doing The Chosen, I was surprised and enjoyed it very much and do enjoy it. It has limitations because we are fallen human beings and Jesus just wasn't. But it's very well done, and they do the right amount of reverence and humanity and truth. You look at the scene in the Chosen where he talks to Nicodemus at night. It's a shot, beautifully rewritten scene, and God bless him.
I know exactly the scene you're talking about, and it was one of the most moving experiences of that first season of The Chosen. I think Jonathan Rumi definitely does bring the humanity and the joy, actually, of Jesus to the screen. So, yes, I'm a fan of The Chosen too. So we've circled around C.S. Lewis a little bit. He's been clearly a leitmotif through your career. Why do you keep coming back to him as the subject of your films?
Because he talks to us well, doesn't he? I mean, he's not 6 foot above contradiction and saying, well, let us have a sermon now. It's not that at all. It's the man who has gone from atheism to agnosticism to a crushingly, amazingly wonderful understanding of Christ as his savior, and then keeps his intelligence, keeps his life, keeps his humanity, and keeps his point of view as a Christian. Now, he still says things. I came across one or two things the other day, and I wish he was here. I'd have a lovely debate with him about it. But he is accessible. And that is not always the case with people who stand in a pulpit or write books about Christianity. He's also honest. Yes, please, the honesty is the thing that matters. Truth, honesty and openness and humanity all come into the rich area of possibilities. If you read C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, I know a guy in the arts who became a Christian just because he understood what was being said and it challenged him, and he thought back and he argued back, but then in the end he ends up a believing Christian, and I'll enjoy watching him dance in heaven because he happened to be a ballet rumba dancer. But it's not putting on airs, graces, or in any way diminishing truth. Quite the reverse.
So Lewis, for you, is the storyteller who tells things as it is, as they are, in a way that connect with people where they are. And of course, that's the job of a storyteller. And I'm intrigued in your Most Reluctant Convert film, which of a few years ago. It starts with a monologue to camera with the older C.S. Lewis relating really all the reasons why he'd rejected faith for so long in his life. And it was a diatribe that could have been written by Richard Dawkins. You know, it didn't pull its punches. And so it almost felt like that Dostoevsky principle of you're putting the best words in the mouth of your opponent rather than saving them for yourself.
All the good music, yeah. It was the truth. It's just simple truth. That's what Lewis wrote about his own beliefs at the time. Lewis looked back at his lack of beliefs and his atheism, and he just told it as it is. Why should we even worry about that? Other than, isn't it wonderful that he actually fell through and there you go, it was true after all, and he got there. But to diminish someone's lack of faith and say we can't talk about that, it'll upset people. Is that what we're saying? I don't think we should. I think we should say Jesus is there, God's just waiting, and let's see what happens. And in Lewis's case, not just in stories either, but he could express truth. Do you know, I think the best book that he probably ever wrote was A Grief Observed. And what that is honesty that earns the right to be heard. And the man's thinking, life, and experiences deserve the right to be heard because he's earned it by the honesty of this book. The honesty of the death of the woman he loved, the only woman he ever loved and married, Joy Davidman, died painfully. Figure that out, God. Painfully, and he watched it go, and he rocked on his heels by this complete destruction of the world of happiness he'd had with this lady, this woman, his wife. And he told it honestly, and he never gets to the last page. He doesn't get the last page and sings the hallelujah chorus. Gets to the last page, he's still in trouble. But I know people that have read that book, and they, especially people who have had deaths in their lives or just a tragedy has happened, and they understand it utterly and listen to what he says elsewhere as well because of that. We have to dare to be honest. And he did that, and it's incredible because his faith did come back with strength and with wisdom and with tremendous empathy by the end of that. And yet he didn't spare the horses, as you put it, by pretending it was all right and God's under control. He didn't feel that at the time. He told us it as a Christian in trouble, honestly, and came through it. That's life. We can't pretend we're wrapped up in cotton wool and can't say boo to a goose. For goodness sake, Lewis did that in that book, and I will be ever grateful that he did.
And I wonder whether some of the churches that preach a more of a prosperity gospel that have a sense that if you do the right things, you'll be blessed by God. And if something's going wrong, it shows that you're not doing the right things. Lewis blows that completely out of the water. I wonder whether we're making some churches who have gone heavily down that line, I wonder if they're making quite fragile Christians. And I wonder whether even people are real within those congregations.
I think it's a modern day form of heresy. I mean, real heresy. I mean, ask Job whether God was kind to everyone at the time. And he had his reasons, and Job made it okay. But what about all those kids that he lost, the children? What about all the rest of it? Did he have to have that many boils, really? Really? Mm-hmm. And you know, if you start saying, oh, you live good and you'll get a bigger car than mine, except I'm being very good and my car is bigger than yours, it makes me want to vomit, actually. It's got so little to do with Jesus. Mm. And it has everything to do with greed, materialism, and stupidity. Because it isn't real. And I've been to some of those churches, and I did for a while back in the 70s and 80s gnash my teeth against the tele-evangelists. Mm-hmm. I used to know Andre Crouch, who is a black gospel singer, and they had him on because he's a good Christian guy. He was a great singer. And basically, they had him here and say, well, how do you feel, Andre? Isn't God great? Yes, God's great. And he was looking miserable. And he told me, he said, I was going through a bad time and a dark time with God. My prayers couldn't get through. You know the feeling. And they kept wanting him to smile and say, hey, hi. And he said, no, I don't want to smile. I'm in real questioning times over X and Y and Z because of the stuff. And all their phone lights behind them, they try to get people to donate money and make them richer. So it all started to light up because people empathized with where he was, Andre Crouch. So they wanted him to fix a false smile and pretend everything was glorious and God's a good prosperity gospel guy, isn't he? And he just blew it away and said no. The sadness of that story is the next week, or the next day, I guess, when they had this, the next thing, they were back to smiling and fixed smiles. Mm-hmm. And we know all about fixed smiles. It's reality. But can you not see the fakery of, that's machinations to get them richer, just to tell them everything's okay. And I see an old lady, and I think she's in Florida. She has a $100 bill tucked away for bad times. I wanted to pick up that $100 bill, and I wanted to send it to my wonderful prayer box or whatever it is they do. You know, and it's just really bad stuff. And they didn't survive. Even Ernest Angely with the singing toupees did not survive, thank goodness. You can't mess with God without having problems. And I think they really messed with God.
But I think even at a lesser level, I think that there's an element of that that survives in many churches that I've been to. They might not preach that quite as explicitly as you've just outlined. And yet there's a subtext where we're expected to have these perfect lives. And it just worries me that there's an unreality to a lot of what goes on. People aren't honest about where they are sometimes.
So you say an unreality, I say an unbiblicalness. Because where in the Bible do you discover all this? You know, Peter sang happily all the way. Paul was put in jail. And yes, he could sing when he was there with Silas and in the stocks for the right reasons. And he had the Lord bearing up his spirit and giving him energy and life at that point was wonderful. He was singing praises to God. Fine. But where are you going to get prosperity gospel or we're meant to be happy all the day or you're wrong? Where do you find that in Scripture? Scripture tells the truth. And Jesus is the center of the Scripture that tells the truth. And God's a big, all of it's there to tell the truth. And if you start saying, you know what? If we just sing another happy chorus and if we're not happy by the end of it, you know, there's something wrong with you, yeah, that's not life. And Lewis knew this and many, many others. In fact, any person you would like to call a saint, and I don't mean necessarily in the Catholic sense, God-centered people with wisdom and the life of the Lord in them, they know what it's all about. And so do we. Read the Bible. Just read the Bible.
And I wonder whether this is at the heart of some of the trend for deconstruction, as it's often called, where people are deconstructing their faith because they've inherited a fragile faith that includes all of these errors. And so it's probably a good thing to deconstruct that. But that's not a rejection of faith. It should be embracing a more real biblical understanding of who God is.
I've never heard of the deconstructionists. I'm obviously in Scotland where they haven't reached this yet, perhaps. But no, you're absolutely right, of course. The thing is, what we're talking around here is doctrine, really, I suppose. The strong doctrines of the faith are as true when Columba came over and brought Christianity to Britain in 564, he had strong doctrine, beliefs, and appreciation. He also had the joy of the Lord, a full life, and an amazing amount of wisdom, knocks, and turns that kept him still at the age of 70 before he died, absolutely still in love with God. And that's the point. There are strengths and pillars of wisdom in Christian doctrine, and alongside that is the joy of the Lord and knowing the truth and the fullness. I don't want to throw that word away easily. Fullness of the Christian faith and love for Christ. It's all there and it's rich. And if you take, is that making a fruitcake? You know, why am I saying that, for goodness sake? But it is, because if you leave the currants out or you leave the orange peel out, whatever, it isn't the same cake. You've missed stuff out deliberately. And just to go back when you do the prosperity gospel, to leave the currants out of the fruitcake just because you want to get rich yourself is pretty iniquitous. You know, give the whole fruitcake to us, please. Give the whole truth and love Jesus. And that's about it, really, isn't it?
I want to go back to Shadowlands because this is the film that you made, which is based on A Grief Observed, the book that we've mentioned. So you had Joss Ackland playing Lewis, and this was one of your earlier works. You studied for 4 years before you created the film. What took you so long?
I'd worked for the BBC for 4.5 years as a producer and director in a thing called Everyman. It began with Anno Domini, then was Everyman, and I did documentaries. The religious department of the BBC did not do drama. And I began by doing a little film, about a blind and deaf Cornish poet called Jack Clemo, and it was drama done on a documentary budget, which is much smaller, but it was telling stories and it worked. But in a short while after that, I was cutting my teeth in proper drama now, and I went through Jonathan Pryce playing Martin Luther, James Fox being and Bernard Hill doing the Pilgrim Fathers, Lee Remick and Helena Bonham Carter, and Dirk Bogard playing about the dangers of right-wing evangelistic radio and broadcasting. So you've got to get used to your craft, as it were. And Shadowlands was when it all came home for me. I loved that. And the idea of saying, you know, if I was a surgeon, you've got to also practice surgery. You've got to know what you're doing in there. It's a skill, you learn it, and so on. Mm-hmm. I would just say I was from 1980 to 1985, where I was getting into drama, and it was really helpful, really useful, and discovering the rules and ways of doing it. And yes, I'd have liked to do the Lewis first off, but I was ready when I made it in 1984, and it came out in 1985. It's all part of learning the craft and being at the right place at the right time or wanting to get something through, and then you know how to do it, I guess. I love doing it. And it was I think it's still the best film I've ever done. It certainly was the most important one for me. But there were others that were good too. Yeah, you tell stories without, if you told a story without any rise in the voice, and if it was all, once upon a time there was a man, that isn't how you tell a story, is it? So you have to learn how you tell your stories. And when you do it, you can really enjoy it. And I enjoy it.
And with Shadowlands, it was remade several years later with Anthony Hopkins playing the lead. Why do you think it was remade? And how would you contrast the differences between your version and the remake?
It was remade because after the original Shadowlands, I wrote the first two scripts, and Bill Nicholson, because I thought it was going to be a 60 minutes was all they were going to allow me. And it was very rapid stuff. And then Bill Nicholson, wonderful man, William B. Nicholson, came, a friend of mine from the religious department, came and wrote the script with me and the producer. And it was a very good script. He went on to do Gladiator, for goodness sake. He's a very good chap. If you're listening, Bill, hello. He's good. The point was that if when you do something like Shadowlands, and you've got to go into the depths of a person who wrote about his own experiences deeply, and you've got to bring that across too, and his faith. That's, you know, when you've got it right, it works. Then it became a play, and it changed a bit. Bill isn't a Christian, at least. He wasn't last time I spoke to him, but he was interested in other things about it too. And the play was a good play, don't get me wrong. It went well. And then after that, they wanted to make a fair bit of money and a nice success with it being a film, a feature film. The problem is they took the engine out, in my opinion, and I told Bill this. His faith got lost in there. They had Anthony Hopkins, who did a great performance, but dressing up. You remember the scene where he's in his pajamas looking like a tidy little boy that's just brushed his teeth? And he's Dickie Attenborough, who directed it, always wanted the windows to be thrown open, literally, and all this stuff, because he didn't believe in Christianity at all, and he wanted to make it from his own angle, which, of course, you can do. You can do whatever you want. But they missed the heart of Lewis, because they didn't understand his faith, his motivations, and what really made him tick. And it's a very beautifully made film. But it isn't the film. It isn't the story. It wasn't true to him. And I think that's, in a strange way, when we did Shadowlands, there was me, a believing Christian. There was David Thompson, a non-practicing Jew. And there was Bill, an atheist becoming an agnostic. And we kept each other in tie. And what happened? Truth happened. We kept it close to Lewis, who he was, which was great. We had the evidence there. When it, one of us had gone ahead and to make a film, and it was Bill, it wasn't quite the Lewis that is or was, and it lacked that power of his faith. That's all I'll say.
I've heard you say that many a good story has been ruined by a big Hollywood budget. And would you say to some extent money was pulling the shots there, calling the shots?
No, not really. I think what was there was the vision was not a Christian vision, not even a Christian vision. That sounds bad. When Dickie Attenborough made that film, he wasn't interested in the Christian faith, as far as I could see, and he wasn't, that wasn't his focus. His focus was the sadness, the tragedy, the loss of the a man of it with his wife dying and so on. But if you go through that and do not follow what Lewis went through and how he recovered and all his theology and belief, you're missing the toothpaste in the tube, aren't you? It's just an empty tube. And that's what he did. It wasn't money so much. I think you can, of course. We all know. We go and see, I don't know, DC films. They'll never employ me to direct after saying that. But there we are, DC films. In the world can blow up three times in the first 5 minutes. And we say, yeah, oh, very good, yeah. Because it's all special effects. It's all wham, bam, cram. And you can spend $200 million without blinking. And you know what? I've seen a single one-man show look through the screen and break people's hearts and get into the real stuff for 30,000, which sounds a lot, isn't it, when you compare it to 200 million. What I'm saying is money doesn't necessarily make great films. It's needed to make films, of course, but your heart has got to be somewhere else than the special effects and the money. It has to be. And most directors would totally agree with that statement.
I want to talk now about the projects on your desk at the moment, your future projects. It's clear that you're still brimming with ideas. You've still got stories you want to tell. And
too many.
Too many. I know that climate change is one of those things that you want to tackle as an important aspect of the lives of all of us. Sadly, it hasn't really appeared in the election campaigning. As we record this, we're about to go to vote. In a few days, when this is aired, we will know the outcome. But none of the major parties have raised climate change particularly. In fact, they've rowed back from commitments that they'd previously made. Tell us a little bit about your commitment to climate change and why you want to tell the story.
I met a Christian chap at an event, and I heard him saying to my wife, well, of course, I've only got 8 years left, you know. And I could hear that. I was talking to somebody else, and I thought, well, that's a bit steep. What is he on about? I'll talk to him tomorrow. And it was a three-day event, and I went and talked to them. He turned out to be a Christian guy called Peter Harris, who started a charity, a Christian charity, for looking after the world 40 years ago. It's called Arosha. I'd never met him before in my life. But as we talked, I realized he'd talked to the United Nations, he'd done all this, he really knew his research. And the fact is, and was, that people who are in power tend not to want to spend a lot of money on things. They'd rather get back into Westminster and sort it out later. So Rishi goes and says, let's go back to fossil fuels, I'll sell licenses to my friend. Or you get Nigel Farage saying that one of his main platforms is to forget climate change and it's a myth. And Trump, of course, will echo that completely. In other words, it's selfish, get back into power, let me do this, let me do that, and no one really believes it. The fact is, when you look at the facts, and there are enough, we are not going to have a very calm few years ahead of us. Things are going to get hotter, deeper, darker, and that will upset an awful lot of things, including food growing and so on. When you look at what's happening, and why I say that is because there's even a policy, I've seen the documents, where scientists are being advised not to be too negative. because if you're too negative, people won't follow you. They'll just give up. So my dear wife, who does a lot of things in broadcasting and writing books and so on, was interviewing scientists at the Science Centre in Glasgow. A lot of people turned up. And she said to one of these guys, good lecturer, and he was talking well. She said, but you're making it all sound rather positive, aren't you? And he said, well, yes, you know, of course, one has to look on the bright side. She said, well, could you say something negative? Oh, I don't want to do that. She said, well, just something. So for 3 minutes, he said something vaguely negative about it, but then quickly changed back to say we were going to be okay. And afterwards, I went up to him, couldn't help it, and I said, you're a real nice guy. And he said, oh, thank you very much. And I said, I wanted a nasty guy. I wanted someone that was going to tell me the truth. You know that certain things are going to happen, and you steered around them. I heard you, and you're a good man, I can tell, but why are you doing that? If I was living in the Clyde River during by the Clyde River in the shipbuilding during the last war, I would rather know the Hitler was going to bomb the Clydeside places that night or tomorrow night rather than be kept in the dark. He said, but they wouldn't follow you. People won't appreciate it. The point is that people do need to be aware that things are happening, and it's going to get hotter, and it's going to be so on. But how do you do it? Do you lecture? Well, it's possible. Do you make documentaries? I've done a lot of them. Well, you still lecture and harangue them a bit. Why don't you take a page from the post office scandal drama, where you actually see something pretty horrific and you're true about it? And why don't you just actually do it through character and story? Story? Or what? Well, you just say a drama and you follow the characters through, and you're made, what, do you lecture people? No, you make them think. Back to where we began, you make them feel so much they can't help but think. And look what the post office program, a film, drama, has done. We should do it for other things, climate change being one. And I just happened to have found a way in to do that. Based in Gibraltar and making it a very adventurous and fascinating drama that would also leave you with personal questions to answer and make you think more. We can't hide with our head under the duvet and say, wake me when it's over. We can't. So my suggestion is, let's think about it now and do what we can do, but don't rely on the politicians. You watch.
Yeah, when you think in five-year windows of being re-elected, you really want to give people what they want to hear within that five-year window. But a drama of this kind, might it just take its place alongside umpteen other apocalyptic dramas? We're so used to that genre of apocalyptic movie. Isn't there a danger people would just file it under the latest movie that tells us that the world's going to end in disaster?
It's possible. I'm not forcing it on people. I'm just making situations and making people follow the characters in it, the thinking in it, the action in it, but making them face it rather than hide under the duvet. I've got a 5-month-old grandchild at the moment. The other ones too, but 5-month-old little girl, wonderful, and she is going to be 5 and 5 months, 5 years from now, isn't she? So it's a bit of an interest, surely, to see if things are happening and rumbles are happening and we understand things are going on. It's a bit important to try and see if we can do something to help. At the very least, be honest about it and try and face it. There's more lies in politics than in most areas, and more lies in big money than most places. And if we don't say, excuse me, let's just look at that. Let's think, what if that? And I hang my hat actually quite happily on the post office drama. It wasn't very expensive. Toby Jones was brilliant in it, but it had an effect. I get paid money when I have a film to talk to the nation, to talk to the world, to say things that hopefully aren't lies and make you think and make you think further creatively. I have no idea whether we can turn this thing round, but not to mention it seems to me to be very wrong, very wrong.
Does retirement figure at all in your plans?
Can't spell it. It doesn't connect with me. Of course, you know, I will stop at some point, probably directly after this show. Retirement, I don't find it attractive at all. I do like, maybe I'm going to be like my granddad. Maybe I'm going to sit Remy on my knee. Then I will tell stories. And then she will remember it herself. I've got a number of little grandchildren, and if you can't fire them for the future and do it up in some way that will live with them and benefit their lives, and also, why not discover the love of Jesus Christ who is behind it all and is still there wonderfully, then maybe retirement will be fine. This isn't retirement for me, it's my job, I tell stories.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity magazine.